This episode is brought to you by State Farm. If you're a small business owner, you know that it isn't just your business, it's your life. And whatever your business might be, you want someone who understands. That's why you might want to check out State Farm Small Business Insurance. Why? Because State Farm agents are small business owners too, living and working in your community. That means they know what it takes to help you personalize your policies for your small business needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.
Hi, we're Visible. We're the wireless company with nothing to hide. Seriously. Hidden fees? We don't have them. Annual contracts? Not our thing. Great wireless on just one line? Now that's more like it. Get unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month. Taxes and fees included. That's right, $25 a month, every month. Sorry, hidden fees. We're just not that into you. Sometimes the choice is just Visible. Switch today at Visible.com. Rate with service on the Visible plan. For additional terms and network management practices, see Visible.com.
Hi, I'm Kara Swisher, editor-at-large of Recode. You may know me as a startup person or maybe just an upstart, but in my spare time, I talk tech, and you're listening to Recode Decode from the Vox Media Podcast Network. Today in the red chair is Elad Gil, the co-founder of Color Genomics and longtime startup advisor. I've talked to him before about Color Genomics and other things, but now he's the author of a new book called High Growth Handbook, Scaling Startups from 10 to 10,000 People. Elad, welcome to Recode Decode.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's go through your background first before we start, because I want people to get a sense of who you are. You're not just some person pontificating on startups, of which there are many. Yeah. So let's go into what you do and how you got to where you are.
Sure, yeah. I mean, if we want to start at the very beginning, I have sort of a weird background, so...
Go right ahead. Birth is not accepted.
Yeah, I was born in Jerusalem.
Okay. And, next year in, go ahead.
So I got my PhD in biology from MIT. I have a background in math and biology. Mm-hmm. And I moved out here right as the entire internet was collapsing. So I had terrible market timing in terms of moving out here.
So which collapsed? The 2002 one?
The 2002 one, yeah.
Okay.
And so I not only chose the wrong time to come here, I also chose the wrong market. I went and worked at a telecom equipment company.
Oh, nice.
Went through multiple rounds of layoffs. I eventually left that. A year or two later, I joined Google, and I helped start the mobile team there. Helped by Android, was involved with a lot of early things there.
Yeah, that got big, I hear.
I hear so. I don't know if you use it or not. But
no, I don't actually use Apple.
Well, there goes that whole conversation.
I tried. I've tried. It was designed by the Google people. That's all I can say about it.
Yeah, not great UI, but great platform.
Yeah, exactly.
So I left then to start a company that Twitter bought. Twitter bought my company, which is an early data infrastructure company, when Twitter was about 90 people. Mm-hmm. I stuck around.
Explain the company that they bought.
It was basically... is one of the really early developer infrastructure companies, mm-hmm. and it allowed any developer to build a geolocation-enabled application. And so just like Twilio allows you to add telephony or Stripe allows you to add payment, we allowed you to add other features. And Twitter bought us back when they had this thriving developer ecosystem that they were going to really develop.
Remember
and
that?
Obviously that changed. So
they had those big parties and events.
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah,
while it lasted, it was really good. So my role at Twitter was really to help scale the company from 90 people to 1,500 people over 2.5 years. So I was involved with a lot of operationally intensive things there. User growth, analytics, scaling recruiting, the M&A team worked
for
me.
And who was the CEO at this time? Because I don't mean to be that rude. But
sure,
yeah.
When we were acquired, it was Ev. And then as I morphed into broader and broader roles, it was Dick.
Okay. Costolo.
Dick Costolo. And then I left Twitter to start this company, Color Genomics. Along the way, though, I'd been investing in startups and... I've been involved with a number of companies that have really broken out since. So I invested in Airbnb, Coinbase, Instacart, Gusto, Wish, Stripe.
We're going to talk about why you picked them. I want to get into that later. But
sure.
So you were doing investing on the side,
yep.
And then did Color Genomics. And that was a real shift. It goes back to mm-hmm. your roots, obviously, your original roots. And explain Color Genomics. I think it was a real – there was a bunch of people like you that shifted mm-hmm. into medical stuff. Mm-hmm. Which was an interesting...
Sure, yeah. I think the origin of Color was really based on two things. One is my co-founder story, who's now the CEO, Atman Meraki. And he's very public with the fact that he himself is a BRCA2 carrier. His mother's had breast cancer.
This is a carrier for breast cancer.
Exactly. And so he himself has cancer risk in his family. And it was really hard to get information or test results or be able to even take tests for different types of genetic disorders. And so the idea of the company was to ask, how can you build a platform where you marry software to genomics to allow people to really understand what they're at risk for?
Which seems an easy idea, but has been hard for Silicon Valley.
I think in general, healthcare is a very hard industry for a number of reasons.
Google was in it, if you remember.
Yeah, they were in
Microsoft
it, out of it, in it, out
involved,
of it.
So. Whatever. I don't even remember at this point. And there were lots of different startups in the area, but this was one of the first around cancer, especially mm-hmm. breast cancer.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
And different things. And so why did you decide to do that?
Yeah, I think part of it was just the sheer human impact of it. you know, ultimately you hit a point in your career where you want to do things that really empower people in ways that, in this case, are literally life-saving. And that impact has ended up hitting much closer to home in a lot of ways than we expected. So, for example, one of our investors, his fiancée at the time took our test. It turned out she was a BRCA carrier as well. Her mother got tested. It turns out that her mother was a carrier. And so her mother elected to have an oophorectomy, and they found that she had stage 3 cancer at the time. Mm-hmm. And so now every time that I see them, they're now married, they have kids. Every time I see them, they say, well, thank you for saving the our mother or mother-in-law.
Right.
So it's been very
you
powerful.
You don't get that at Twitter. Thank you for that tweet.
I think Twitter's had its own large
we'll
impact.
We'll get into that
later. Yeah, yeah.
But so you did this, and then?
And now, I stepped down as CEO about 2 years ago.
My co-founder, why did you do that?
It was for 3 reasons. Number one is, I've been operating for a long time, and at some point, you just don't want to do yet another sales comp review. Mm-hmm. And so the set of things that I was doing...
Thank you for telling the truth.
Yeah, the set of things that I was doing, eventually, they were still interesting, but it wasn't as novel as the first time I did it. Second, we'd hit a scale of about 100 people or so, and people were ping-ponging between me and Altman for decisions, mm-hmm. and we thought it'd be best to just have one person that you can clearly go to.
Right.
And then lastly, I think Altman... on his side, really wanted to be CEO. He was ready for it. He'd been ready for a decade to be CEO of a company. And so it was the right time to make a transition.
Mm-hmm. And so what do you do for them now? What is your...
I'm a board member now. So I help out where I can, both on the board level. I've been helping out with a couple large partnerships or deals. Mm-hmm. But it's really morphed more and more into a board role versus anything
else. So you've jumped from company to different companies, different areas. A lot of the similar stuff that you were doing. And so you decided to write this book. So explain what was the thinking behind it.
Yeah, the book happened a little bit organically. I sat down over Christmas break about 2 years ago, and I just only wrote for a week because just like with early stage companies, there's the same set of questions over and over again.
Right.
For late stage founders, I kept getting the same questions. And so I said, well, I'll just write this guide and maybe I'll just post it as a website in terms of how do you really navigate high growth and how do you deal with internationalization or M&A or raising late stage funding rounds.
Right.
So I put this thing all together. I was about to launch it as a website. And I was talking to John Collison, one of the founders of Stripe, and I mentioned, I've done this thing. He asked to see it. He circulated to a bunch of his friends, and he wrote back to me a day or two later. And he said, hey, can we actually publish this at Stripe? And so Stripe
now they're big in publish. They publish a lot of stuff.
They publish a lot of stuff. They're quarterly and Atlas Guides and other things. So that's sort of what led to the genesis of the book.
All right. But you sat down. Why did you feel like it? Just because you were like, hey, I had these problems and I just encountered them a lot with the people.
Yeah, it's the same questions over and over. And so I thought, well, maybe I could just direct somebody to a website instead of having to spend an hour talking through the same issue. Although I'm always happy to talk through it.
All right. So talk about what you were thinking then doing the book. You just decided to put it together as a book.
So once Stripe offered to publish it, I said, great, let's go for it.
Right. Because a lot of people do these things on Medium. You get your like 10 things from Y Combinator people. They seem to have one every 5 minutes. You know what I mean?
So,
they're all similar. I don't find many of them that illuminating.
Yeah, I was going to do only top 10 lists, so I thought, but then I pivoted away from that. So the book is basically an intermix of sort of my own direct experiences, and it's very tactical. So, and then interviews with some of the leading lights of Silicon Valley who've operated at scale, like Reid Hoffman or Shannon Stubo or
Shannon's
other folks
best.
Like that.
I'm glad you talked to Shannon.
Yeah, she's very good. So we talked about how do you evolve a marketing communications organization, for example.
Right, for that one.
And so I avoided the sort of canned A players hire A players.
Yeah.
Because that's really non-useful advice.
Yeah, I know.
What do you actually do with that? Are you going to look for A player on the resume or something?
Yeah, right. Yes. I'm an A player. You decide. Yeah, I know.
Exactly.
There's a lot of sort of short, pithy things that I find
that are meaningless.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. And so the purpose of the book was what's
tactical.
The hardcore tactical advice that allows you to really hire an executive team and buy other companies and raise money and all the rest of it.
All right. So let's go through that. Let's start to talk about that in the next section. We'll talk about that also. And then I'd love to know where you think startups are going. Mm. So what do you think that, did you come up with key things, key metrics or key kind of things, or did you just go section by section? So here's the PR part, here's the market.
Yeah, it's literally section by section. So there's a section, for example, on product management and what's a good product management
Well, let's talk about that since you were involved.
Yeah. Fundamentally, it breaks down things like what are the different types of product managers? So do you hire somebody differently if they're focused on a back-end product versus front end, or if they're more business centric versus not. So if you have a SaaS company, you may end up hiring different people than if you have a consumer internet company. So there's a lot of differences in the role. And then there's a set of best practices in terms of how do you actually run a product management organization? How do you think about product road mapping? How do you have a natural tension with engineering and design and other areas? Because you're always going to have tension there, which is good and healthy. And so it sort of goes through those different areas and basically fleshes out, for example, for product management, what are key things you should be doing? How should you be thinking about hiring for it? And how do you think about the set of processes?
And when you're doing this, the idea that is that you, one of the things that startups think of, I want to get to this first, is that they think they're all special, like that they're different than everyone else. And they are quite the same. It's the same person I see across from me a lot of the time. I mean, individually, there's individual differences. But talk about that idea that people do, you know, they have this sort of mythology of Silicon Valley as being this special sparkly place that isn't just like a lot of it is block and tackle. I think about that a lot lately in our own businesses. Some of it's just basic block and tackling that is.
Yeah, I think basically I almost have two opposing views on it. One is that the only good generic startup advice is that there's no good generic startup advice.
Okay. You know,
like everything should be taken in context. But the flip of it is, to your point, there's lots of things that just work. Mm-hmm. And there's no point in trying to reinvent those things. And people who try to reinvent those things tend to fail.
Right.
Like there's a way to do sales that works really well for enterprises. Mm-hmm. And if you start hiring a bunch of PhDs in computer science to do your sales, it's probably not going to work so well.
Right.
And so I do think people try to reinvent things too much or... You know, anytime you see, for example, a company adopting Holacracy, it's like run for the exits.
We've written about that.
Because ultimately there are some ideas that are just fundamentally bad.
Yeah.
Because, you know, people haven't changed in thousands of years in terms of their fundamental drivers. Mm-hmm. And people want clarity of organization. They want a central purpose. They want all these things that if you don't provide them with it, then you'll end up with a more chaotic environment. And I think founders are almost like feral animals. You know, they're like raised in the wild. Many founders, including myself, tend to be, I think, much more okay with chaotic environments. They may not like hierarchy as much. Mm-hmm. They may not like a lot of things that drive them to be founders.
Right.
But then they assume that everybody else that they hire is the same way.
Right. That's a very good point.
And in reality,
that's actually an excellent
people
point.
Are very different, right? Mm-hmm. Most people that you're going to hire are employees for a reason. Mm-hmm. And they want stability, and they want common purpose, and they want focus, and they want to know who their manager is.
Right.
And they want to have a career ladder and career path. So I do think that that's one of the big mistakes that founders often make is they impose their own or project their own views onto others.
Well, that happens a lot, correct? I mean, when you think about sort of, before we get into actually the specifics, I would love to get this a general idea. I mean, what do you think some of the myths of a Silicon Valley entrepreneur are that aren't so?
I think there's a number of them.
That one is a very, because they do impose their it's really fast. Well, it's because they're egomaniacs much of the time.
There's giant
myths. Not you. Yeah. Everybody else.
You say that and look away. You're like, not
when
you.
When you leave, I'll say
everybody else. Yeah, I know.
Egomaniac, too. Yeah. No.
So I'll give you an example myth that I think is very.
Go ahead.
One example myth would be that you need co-founders.
Yeah.
And so if you look at the most successful companies in technology, at least by market cap, it's either ones where there was a strong single founder or there was a dominant founder who really just made the decisions. Apple would be an example of that. Mm-hmm. LinkedIn, it was mainly Reid Hoffman. Facebook, it was largely Zuck.
Partners. They have secondary partners like Gates and Ballmer. That was critical.
Yeah, they have secondary partners, but Ballmer came in when they were 20 people or something.
Right.
And so I think it's more about constantly finding people in the organization who are going to be that central partner, to your point. Mm-hmm. But I think that's different from needing a co-founder at day one.
Right, right.
And so you
it's
end
the
up...
Larry and Sergey disease, I think.
Yeah,
twin,
exactly.
The evil twin disease.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, I think they pulled it off. I think Stripe's pulled it off. There's a couple companies
that
have.
There was a dominant partner there, too. At which
Google?
Is Larry, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely.
Yeah.
And so I do think that people over-index on, is there a co-founder or not? And I think in general, sometimes it's better not to have a co-founder because you can make decisions cleanly. You don't have to argue about everything. You know, like there's a lot of things that it actually cleans up.
Yeah, that's why I had to kill Malt Mossberg eventually.
Oh, are you serious? That's where he went. I was wondering if it's behind those super cartons on the floor over here.
It worked out for me. It's a struggle.
Yeah.
We ended up agreeing a ton. So it worked out well. And we had different points of view. But it's an interesting thing to think about.
Yeah.
So that's one. So not 400. What else?
Yeah. I think the other big myth is the extent that people focus actually on the founding team and the founders versus on the market. And so I think Andy Ratcliff from Benchmark has this great sort of Ratcliff's Law, which is...
Oh, he has a law?
Yeah. You haven't heard the law?
Had a law. Oh my God. No, please.
Yeah. So Ratcliff's Law is, great team, terrible market, market wins.
Okay. Great team. Terrible market, market wins.
Yes,
absolutely.
Terrible team, great market, market wins. And great team, great market, something magical happens.
Right, okay.
And I think the middle one is the most interesting one.
Yeah.
Which is if you have product market fit.
Right.
And
you're right.
Your product is just working. It kind of doesn't matter that much initially how bad the team is.
Right.
It matters later. It's the difference between a $10 billion market cap and a $100 billion market cap. But fundamentally, if you have something good enough, unless you have a very strong competitive environment,
like Microsoft,
then you're going to succeed.
Yeah.
And I think the other sort of contrarian thing that I've learned recently is
that's a good law, Andy. I was going to make fun of him. That's a good law.
It's actually a pretty good one.
Yeah.
The thing that I learned recently, which I was surprised by, is when you do reference checks on founders, for example, if you're looking to invest, a good reference check is definitely a positive signal.
Right.
But a negative reference check is a neutral signal.
Okay, explain that.
So I'll give you an example. When I worked at Twitter, there was somebody who was always just hanging out in the hallways. Really sharp person, but never seemed really effectual, didn't really get anything done. Mm-hmm. Everybody thought this wasn't like the greatest person in the world. And that person now has one of the most successful companies out of Twitter.
Okay.
And so, you know, if somebody had called me and asked, what do you think of this person? I would have said, oh, this person's like not very good. I would never back them.
Right.
And I've seen that with other companies as well that have now become actually quite large companies where people passed because they did a reference check and the person wasn't great. So I took him to dinner a couple of weeks ago and I said, hey, what happened? You know, how'd you become so good all of a sudden?
Right, because you sucked, right?
Yeah. I didn't say you sucked. Yeah. I said very politely. I was like, well, you know, Twitter, you seem kind of, you know.
Out of it.
And he said, I finally feel like my ass is on the line.
Ah.
And so it was contextual, but it wasn't contextual that people always talk about where founders will fight with their managers and their strong personalities. It was more the guy was just kind of, eh.
Yeah.
And
he
went on to do great things because he suddenly got really motivated. And I thought that was a really interesting insight.
So negative ones are a neutral signal. Not always, though. I think
if it's ethics or other things, it's usually negative.
Right.
But if it's, you know, we just don't think that person's very good, sometimes it doesn't matter.
Although, you know, interestingly, I think about that because I was given mostly positive references on someone a long time ago that I hired. And there was one sort of offhand one. I ran into someone who had worked for them and they said something. And the problem that person later had was exactly what the offhand person said, not what the positive people. Yeah. It was an offhand. It was a lower level person, and it wasn't meant to be mean, and I wasn't seeking the thing, and it was exactly what the problem was.
No, and I think reference checks are crucial.
It stuck with me, I remember.
Yeah. And I would actually, for employees, I think it's a very clear signal. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying for founders, it isn't necessarily a negative signal. Mm-hmm.
So you don't know who's going to shine.
You just have no idea. And part of that is that middle tier of Ratcliffe's Law.
Right.
But part of it is also the motivation shifts strongly enough that sometimes somebody shifts as well.
All right, one more, and then we're going to talk about specific things in the next section.
Yeah.
Specifically Silicon Valley.
Like a Silicon Valley myth?
Yeah. I can come up with some.
Yeah, I'd love to hear yours.
I think the founder is God myth, I think. I think you're right about there not needing to be partners. Mm-hmm. But I remember one thing Steve Jobs once said to me. He was talking about the company, and he said this was offhand, and he said it backstage, and he's like, everyone always thinks I do everything. And you know, he had a healthy ego, more than healthy ego. But he's like, he thinks everybody there is an Oompa Loompa at Apple, and actually it's a stronger team, and they don't notice it. And he hated that. He, as much as he liked the attention, I think he also understood that he had a strong team behind him.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, startups are really team efforts. Mm-hmm. And so one of the advice I often give founders as they're scaling is you actually don't need to do all the stuff that you think you need to do.
Right.
You need to find people who can.
Right.
And then empower them, and then you have like a team going after it. I mean, honestly, one of the bigger Silicon Valley myths, just to add a final one, is the degree to which contrarianism tends to be correct.
Exactly.
Contrarianism usually is wrong.
Yeah.
And that's why it's contrarianism.
Yeah.
And people who are often contrarian are actually often wrong as well. It's just sometimes they really hit it.
It's called frequently wrong, but never in doubt.
Yeah, exactly. And so I actually thought it'd be really cool to construct a 2x2 matrix of people who are contrarian versus people who use 2x2 matrices. Mm-hmm. And so in your upper right hand, who's both contrarian and makes matrices, is Peter Thiel in his book. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's people who are contrarian but don't make matrices, like Keith Raboy. Mm-hmm. And then you have people who make 2x2 matrices but aren't contrarian, like McKinsey consultants.
Okay, explain 2x2 matrices.
Right? Oh, I'm sorry, a 2x2 matrix. We can skip this topic too, but a 2x2 matrix is basically a... you have two axes, a y-axis and an x-axis, and it's a box, and you have four boxes, and you say, okay, let's divide things up into two characteristics and ask who has both characteristics, who has one or the other characteristic, and who has none. Yeah. And so for contrarianism, you can construct your own matrix. And it was sort of driven by Peter Thiel's book.
Right. So there's one in New York Magazine that's despicable and lowbrow and highbrow. It's great. There's all the despicable, laudable and stuff. So go ahead, finish with that. So contrarianism.
Yeah, so I think contrarianism.
Which is very much celebrated in Silicon Valley.
It's very celebrated, and rightly so, because I think if you're constantly falling into the status quo, you're never going to do anything great.
Right.
And so you do have to question things. You do have to look at fundamentals. But most people who are contrarian and consistently contrarian are actually wrong. And you meet them sometimes and you can't help but eye roll because you're like, ugh, like another.
I'm a contrarian.
I'm just saying the opposite of everything that everybody else is saying.
I just wrote a column about in the New York Times about Twitter. And someone's like, well, they just have always had a contrarian viewpoint. I said, and yet they can be wrong.
Yeah,
like,
and they've been wrong the whole time. Yeah.
Like being contrarian is not enough in and of. They have a contrarian values. I'm like, they don't have any values. They're just being contrarian.
Yeah.
Like, I don't get it. Like, that's just, that's what a 3-year-old does.
You have to be contrarian and right.
Have something behind it, like, but it tends to be like celebrated. I don't, you know, because there is a thing of like when we started this podcast, nobody thought we should do it. And we just did it. I liked him. But it wasn't contrarian. It was I just like it. You know, it was an interesting thing. All right, when we get back, we're talking. This is a really interesting discussion with Elad Gil. He's the author of a new book, High Growth Handbook, Scaling Startups from 10 to 10,000 People. We're going to talk about that when we get back. And then later, we're going to talk more about where startups are in Silicon Valley now.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You've heard it before. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. But it's more than just a tagline. Because State Farm agents are small business owners themselves who live and work in your community. And if you're in the market for small business insurance, who better to work with than an agent who understands what it takes? State Farm agents can help you create a personalized insurance plan that fits your small business needs and budget. Talk to your local State Farm agent today about small business insurance. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Hi, we're Visible. We're the wireless company with nothing to hide. Seriously. Hidden fees? We don't have them. Annual contracts? Not our thing. Great wireless on just one line? Now that's more like it. Get unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month. Taxes and fees included. That's right, $25 a month, every month. Sorry, hidden fees. We're just not that into you. Sometimes the choice is just Visible. Switch today at Visible.com. Rate with service on the Visible plan. For additional terms and network management practices, see Visible.com.
We're here with Elad Gil, who's the author of a new book, High Growth Handbook, Scaling Startups from 10 to 10,000 People. He's also quite fascinating. Talk a little bit about this specifically. So you go through product marketing.
Yeah.
What else?
Yeah, sure. So there's sections on the role of the CEO. So what should you actually be doing as CEO should be focusing on. There's managing your board. So how do you deal with board members who aren't acting correctly? Can you remove them? Can you not? How do you think about constructing your board to begin with?
Right.
And I should say for each of these sections interwoven, there's specific interviews on those topics. So, for example, in the board section, there's
an interview
with Reid Hoffman around how does he think about board members and, you know, how to manage the board effectively. So that'd be another
example. Talk about that, because I was just debating someone this issue, the boards, because they were there was an idea that you should put workers on the boards, on every board, and should it be legislated or not? I think it is a great idea. I think it's always a great idea to get workers on the board and legislate it if you have to, because usually they pack these things with their friends and idiots. So it tends to be, you know, it never tends to be a very good board. And Silicon Valley boards, I've written about quite a lot, are quite weak. I mean, as far as I can tell, some of them are. They don't think they are, but they often pack them with VCs. There's always, it's typically white guys. It's, you know, they grudgingly put a woman on, even though they're their customer. You know what I mean? Anyway, talk about sort of how boards are comprised.
Yeah, I think really the way to think about your board is to evolve it. So to your point, what may be right really early, which is the founders and a couple of VCs, maybe a terrible board
well,
later.
Really right.
As a company
it just
skills.
Is. I don't ever think it was right in the first place.
It depends on what you're looking for from a board. I think in general, venture capital is a bundled product.
Right.
Right. So it's a bundle of advice, money,
allegedly,
and governance.
I think it's just money.
And no, I was about to say, in many cases, you know, nobody's great at all those three things, or very few people are. And so my argument is actually it shouldn't be a bundled product, right? It should be unbundled.
Right.
And you should have great people on the board
that's
who are amazing at advice and governance, and you can get capital separately.
Right.
And to some extent, you could argue the cryptocurrency world is doing that very badly, right? Like they've sort of taken that to the opposite extreme in terms of not really thinking through some of these structures. But fundamentally, you have this bundled product, and it's an accident of history, right? Because some of the people who are giving money back then actually were helpful or you know, did have advice. And that's shifted dramatically. That said, you know, when you start thinking through who you want on your board as an early stage company, you do want to look for people who are able to help with those other elements and not just give you money. And there's only a handful of people who are really good at that in Silicon Valley.
Right. Right?
Most investors are not great at that.
Yeah.
As your company starts to scale, the set of issues change pretty dramatically, right? You go from, you know, an early stage company where there's really honestly only three things you have to do as an early stage company. These are hard things, but don't run out of money.
Right.
Find product market fit and don't fight with your co-founder.
Right.
And if you do those three things, you'll succeed.
Yep.
And that's it. That's all an early stage company has
to
do.
All right, then.
It's really hard,
though. Break them all.
It's really hard. A late stage company is way more complicated. You have new functions to run that you've never actually been involved with.
Right.
You're internationalizing. You're buying companies. You're launching new product lines that you didn't have before.
Right. The scaling of employees.
You're scaling sales and other things. So you have all these different things going on. And the board should sort of evolve with that because suddenly you're going to need people who can help you with some of those things or who understand the market and the regulation or who understand other aspects. And to your point, there's also that the key aspect of board diversity of also finding people who then reflect your user base or the employee base that you want.
I'm not just saying that. I'm not trying to be reductive. It's just a really interesting thing when they all evolve in exactly the same way. And it's not the right way necessarily. And I think a lot of their problems always evolve from the lack of viewpoints, like that they didn't think of it because they can't pick their head up off the table and look around and see people just like them. You're not going to get the correct viewpoint.
Yeah, I think that's starting to evolve a bit, but it's going to take time.
Why doesn't it evolve? What do you...
I think there's a couple of hard problems. Or they're not hard, but there's problems. Mm-hmm. One is just often boards are sort of network driven.
Yes.
And, you know, I have a section in the book actually about avoid the VC crony. You know, Right. Don't find the person that's always doing things with the VC who gets added to your board and they're basically like a proxy. Right. Really what you should be doing is looking really broadly and asking, what are we really looking for? And the way I think of a board member, and I think Reid Hoffman actually made this point in the book as well, is it's somebody that you'd love to work with or even co-found a company with, but you can't hire.
Mm-hmm.
And so that should be the type of person that you're looking for as a board member.
Right.
You know, and... Right. That may have different characteristics in terms of the market you're in or how you're thinking about the future evolution of what you're doing. For example, Coinbase added Katie Hahn to the board in part because of her regulatory expertise and background, mm-hmm. right? And I think that was a good example where they said, okay, who can help us with something that's really important for the industry that we're in and who are the best people for that? And let's add them on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't happen because the founders don't have guts or what, or they're just not thinking of that as a useful function
for
them.
Well, I think early on, they just don't have a better idea or they don't know. I mean, mm-hmm. you're learning so much. So say that you're a 23-year-old engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And you've never been exposed to any of these things. You've never mm-hmm. been exposed to boards or governance or companies at any real scale. Mm-hmm. This is all new. And you're learning 30 different things simultaneously while you're also trying to keep a product going and a company up. And you're learning management mm-hmm. for the first time. And you're learning new functions for the first time. It's actually really hard.
Right.
And the first time people go through it, it's just this chaotic roller coaster. And it's very emotional and awful. Mm-hmm. The second time people go through it, it tends to get better.
Right.
But the first time is always awful.
Right. Right. So it's lack of knowledge.
It's total lack of knowledge.
So when you say it's gone too slow, and then I want to get on to another topic, why does it go? I really want to get at the heart of why it goes slow. Because mm-hmm. it's a really interesting thing. Because it should be. You know, I think what happens is now it feels like mm-hmm. eat your vegetables uh-huh. or homework or something like that. When it really mm-hmm. isn't, it's actually better. And years ago, I often tell this story, mm-hmm. is when Twitter had 10 same white men on yeah. the board. And Dick and I would argue about it. And he was like, well, it just happened that way. And I was like, mm-hmm. how could it? Like, don't you want to know how it happened? Mm-hmm. Like, aren't you thinking hard about how that got?
I think every late stage company that I'm involved with at this point is thinking about adding diversity to their board.
Right.
So that's why I'm saying
it's not diversity for diversity's sake. Besides being sure. the right thing to do, which
yeah.
it is,
sure.
and that's a very good reason to do mm-hmm. anything in life, mm-hmm. It's almost as if they're willfully trying to be worse at what they do, like by not understanding mm-hmm. more viewpoints, not being challenged. I'm not sure.
I don't know. I think I don't think people are purposefully avoiding being challenged, mm-hmm. at least the best founders that I know aren't. I'm sure there's people who are, right?
I guess I feel like they find boards useless or something, so who cares?
I think if, to your point, you basically keep 5 VCs on a board forever, it's going to be useless once you become a
yeah.
late-stage public company.
But
or
there
a public
they sit.
Company. They've started moving people off more aggressively.
Yeah.
You see some of these transitions. To your point on the Twitter board, there were some people who were actually helpful throughout the life of the company, like mm-hmm. Peter Fenton, mm-hmm. who I think was always a great board member. But I think they basically turned over the board 2 or 3 times now, in part to start to change that mix
right.
and ask, who do we want on here and what
so
sort of people
what are the
do we need?
two or three key things in boards? No cronies. What else?
No cronies. Really think about it as somebody that you would have loved to hire or brings a unique skill set to the team.
Mm-hmm.
And then lastly, find somebody who also respects you.
Right.
Because the worst thing you can do is have sort of the old timer who's giving
come
you,
at you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. All right. Let's get to another topic, which is employees and trying to scale employees.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that. Because one thing I noticed a lot of companies, AOL, lots of companies, they have this group of people at the beginning that just aren't going to make it. Now, mm-hmm. I remember going out to lunch with someone who was going to be incredibly wealthy at AOL in the early days.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, I'm like, you're not going to make it.
Yeah.
They're going to push you out of the boat. And you should be. You should jump
mm-hmm.
because you got your money. Go off and do something else.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a really interesting thing because it's a hard thing emotionally because a lot of these teams were tight together initially. So can you talk about that?
Yeah. I think it's really hard for people who were really early at a company.
Like the 10.
Yeah. The first 10 people or the first 20
Google
people.
Google was full of them.
It had a lot of them. And I call it like old timer syndrome, irrespective of the age, right? It's
mm-hmm.
more just people who'd been at the company since the origins, and that could be 4 years ago. It didn't have to be that long ago.
Yeah, yeah.
And they feel a little bit overly empowered and important relative to the company.
Yes, exactly.
And so I think the key thing is that really what you need to focus on is explaining to those people that the company's evolving, the culture's evolving. They're not going to be having lunch with the CEO every day like they used to. Mm-hmm. They're not going to be have input
in
every decision. Like
one of them was always, I'm on the plane. Like
that's probably a Google story.
Yeah, it is. Of course it is.
And so, you know, really their role is going to evolve. And really what's going to happen is their role is going to shrink and then it'll expand later because they have the trust of the founders. They have the context. They have all the things that actually make them incredibly valuable. But they can't throw a mini fit about the fact that they're losing responsibility.
Yeah.
And you know, an example of that would be, say that you're the first designer at a company and you're designing the whole product and the surface area keeps growing, and then suddenly they hire two more designers and your role just shrunk by a third.
Right.
Sometimes you may get really upset about that and you may fight with the new people and try and grab things. In reality, what you should be doing is saying, this is awesome, let's continue to build out the team. Because if you act well and you're helping others, eventually you may become the manager of that group, right? You may get more and more responsibility.
Right.
So a general rule is your responsibility will shrink and then it'll expand and you need to be okay with that shrinking.
You can't think about that. And what if you're the actual founder that has to do that when someone just isn't up to the task?
Yeah, the hard part is many founders make two mistakes. One is they tolerate good instead of great in a role, in part because of that relationship to that prior person.
Yes.
And secondly, they cut way too much slack, even if the person's doing an awful job, because they feel like they owe them for the early efforts that they made.
Right.
And I do agree they owe them for the early efforts they made, and obviously they're well compensated financially and other things. But I think fundamentally what you owe is the organization and the 100 other people that came in on top of them who now are being impacted by this person who may be acting in a negative way. One of the interviews in the High Growth Handbook was with Ruchi Sanghvi, who was an early engineer and then product person at Facebook. And she talks in the book about how in the early days at Facebook, she and then later she sold the company at Dropbox, right? So she said at Facebook, she was the person who was always fighting everybody new and fighting process and throwing a fit. And then when she came into Dropbox through the acquisition, her job was to be that old time, that new person coming in and instilling process and changing things.
Right.
And she saw the resistance on the other side. And she said that was a really key learning moment in terms
of
these two aspects.
Yeah, that's the way we do it here.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like to blow things up all the time. So I'm just like, someone was like, well, we did it for, I'm like, I don't care. Like it's, and it's hard for people. And it's actually sometimes a test. Like, can you move along? That's hard. All right. Then the last thing in this section. So when you're a founder, the same thing, stepping aside, the idea that you're not the one.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you have to be.
Pierre Omidyar was sort of the best example of.
Pierre was good at that. Reed did that really well, too, I feel. So I think there's a few people who've done it. I think one of the big shifts in Silicon Valley, and I call it like the Sheryl Sandberg effect, was that transition from the hired gun CEO always coming in to people coming in as really strong COOs and complementing the founder. And that's done two things. One is I think it's helped founders grow and evolve and continue to have their vision. The negative version of it is that it's enabled people to stick around when maybe they shouldn't,
right?
Because they're sort of being propped up a little bit.
Right.
I think fundamentally it comes down to, do you have the self-awareness to decide that it's the right moment for you to go and for somebody else to come on board and replace
you? And how
you.
Do you do that? How does...
I think it's a few things. One is looking and seeing if things are breaking because of you, and if so, can you fix that or not? So if you're constantly the bottleneck for everything, you're not doing things right, how do you fix that? And again, if you're managing people for the first time and doing all this for the first time, I think it's a great opportunity to learn things, and you need to be willing and open-minded to do that. You should do maybe a 360 feedback cycle, so you get feedback from everybody around you so you can understand what your issues are or how you can improve. So a lot of it is focusing on getting better first through getting information or data around what's going wrong, then finding people who can help you in terms of building out those skills. And if none of that's working, you may decide, you know what, maybe it is time for somebody else to come in.
For someone to come in. And that's a hard thing because a
really
lot
hard.
Of them don't. And that's usually where the fatal error comes. And very few can evolve. I mean, I think like Jeff Bezos was an evolver. He evolved and stayed, you know, fresh in that role and has obviously continued to. A little bit of more maturity does help in that ability to do that.
Maturity absolutely helps. And I actually think that's one of the interesting things is as you watch certain founders age, you know, some companies I've been involved with now for 10 years, you know, over their life cycle. And you actually see the founders growing up and evolving and maturing in exactly those ways.
Ryan Chesky.
And yeah, no, great example, right? Like he's really stepped up in amazing ways.
And I didn't think
CEO.
He was going to make it, but then he did.
But he did, right? Yeah. And so I do think sometimes cutting people slack and saying, look, they're a young person figuring this out, let's help them, is often a better stance than, hey, let's just get rid of them, which was which was the 90s.
Right, which is get rid of them and replace them with someone else,
exactly.
You know, which is the classic Steve Jobs mistake, right? Although not a bad thing for him or them at the time. Like it did create a situation where he got better.
Absolutely. I think if he hadn't come back and Apple had died at that moment, people would have interpreted it very differently in all sorts of ways, which I think is fascinating. It's sort of an alternative timeline.
Absolutely. We're talking to Elad Gil. He's the co-founder of Color Genomics. He's also the author of a new book called High Growth Handbook, Scaling Startups from 10 to 10,000 People. When we get back, we're going to talk more about that and then some individual companies he's worked with.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Life moves pretty fast. Are you drinking water that can keep up? Smartwater Alkaline has everything you need to stay hydrated, no matter where your day takes you. Whether you're pitching a tent or your next big idea, Smartwater Alkaline can help you perform your best. It delivers a pure, crisp taste that makes it the perfect chaser after a big workout. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
We're here with Elad Gil. He's the co-founder of Color Genomics, but right now he's talking about his new book called High Growth Handbook. Let's talk about this idea of growth, high growth. Like, it's such a thing in Silicon Valley, and a lot of people now, including the growth at all costs, has costs.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just that these companies don't pay for them. I've written about Facebook and Twitter and others.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about what's happened in Silicon Valley right now in the startup culture, because I think there's a real, some people think the startups are sort of not dying off, but that the big companies are not dominating everything. Some people feel the innovation cycle is at a low point. I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Sure. I think from an innovation cycle perspective, Arthur Patterson, the one of the co-founders of Excel,
that's right,
has this great cycle that he sort of mapped out when basically what happened is in the late 90s, Excel made a bunch of investments that turned out to be bad investments. In the early 2000s, their fund almost went under. And so a lot of their LPs pulled out. And so Arthur Patterson looked back over history in terms of venture over the last 30 years and came up with a, what some people now call the Patterson venture cycle, in terms of saying, you know, there's these different cycles of technology waves, and he tried to convince people that they were at a low point. And then obviously 2 years after that, that's when Excel made the famous Facebook investment, and it sort of really catapulted them to the next level. You know, so personally, I do think we're at sort of the lull in a venture cycle right now from the perspective of we just had SaaS, mobile, and social all overlapping each other as three big waves.
Right.
And I feel like that those waves kind of broke in 2016, but nobody really noticed, and sort of the capital in the market just kept going.
Right.
And so I do think we, at least personally, I've seen less innovative companies relative to the number of companies that exist. In other words, good companies versus all companies has kind of shrunk as a proportion.
It
and
has
I think
certainly.
Part of that's driven
you
by
can't think
why
of
not?
One.
Think of a good one?
You can't think of one. I mean, you used to think of 10. Like, you know what I mean?
I think there's some pretty good ones still, but I think it's rare.
But newer ones. I'm saying newer ones and more fresh ones.
Yeah.
What would you say? I'm just curious if you want to name names.
I mean, there's a few companies that I think are really interesting. Airtable would be one. Checker would be one. Front would be one.
Wait, Airtable.
So, Checker.
Right.
Front.
Mm-hmm.
Matilde's company. She's very good. So I think there's a few of these that, you know, are doing really
interesting. And in what areas are there? Do they have to be in subject matter areas or?
You know, I think the most interesting subject matter areas right now are basically semiconductors for machine learning. So things that'll actually compete with NVIDIA GPUs. I think there's fascinating stuff happening there. And nobody's doing semiconductor investing anymore.
Yep.
But
you're
actually
right.
Think that's,
you're absolutely right.
That's
NVIDIA's
a really interesting
really
area.
A big breakout.
NVIDIA's been a huge breakout. And if you compare them to things like
that
Google's.
Guy's smart.
Yeah, he's quite good.
Ball.
Yeah. If you compare what NVIDIA is doing to, you know, Google, who's built their own custom silicon for machine learning, Google's hardware is way better. And so there's now startups trying to build that outside of Google.
Right.
So I think that's a really interesting area. I think just ongoing SaaS and things like that. There's a dozen new giant SaaS companies to build. And then I actually think
in what areas?
I think what Checker's done, for example, where they've made a background checking API and just taken something that companies do over and over again.
Yep.
I think there's like a dozen of those if you just were to decompose a Fortune 500 company. And then lastly, I think crypto is fascinating, and it's basically a giant form of value creation coupled to 95% crap. And so it's this really interesting dual wave of really interesting fundamental things. I've actually been avoiding all crypto parties.
Yeah, don't go to them.
Yeah,
they're going dark now.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
There's used to be some fun ones now. Oh, don't even talk to me about that. So go ahead, crypto. Talk about
it. Yeah, so I think crypto is really interesting, and I think there's a fascinating analogy to the 90s where there's a handful of things that were founded in the 90s internet that turned out to be extremely valuable. You know, Amazon would be one, PayPal, et cetera. There was things that came a few years later, like Google, Facebook, et cetera. I guess Google was founded then, but it was private. And I think in crypto, we're in a similar wave where there's tons of stuff in the 90s that was crap that went to zero. There's tons of stuff that ended up being really valuable. And then actually, I think the most fascinating segment are things that in the 90s looked like craters and everybody made fun of, and now have come back in a new form today that's really successful.
Such as?
Webvan into Instacart.
Right.
Or
No, they were always good ideas.
There was great ideas.
It was timing and execution.
Pets.com, everybody made fun of Pets.com. Now Chewy sold for $2 billion plus, right?
Right.
And so there's a couple of these. And I think in crypto, it'll be the same
timing.
Thing where the market, there's all sorts of things people
Newton
are doing, which is just
or
stupid.
General Magic, there's just been a movie on it. That was right.
Yeah.
That was wrong. You know what I mean? It's just timing in a lot of ways. And execution, timing and execution.
Yeah.
And then you have to have all the pieces in place.
Exactly.
To make it. So how do you assess the startup culture right now? Because, again, a lot of people feel it is a little desiccated out there.
I think there's fewer.
And the impact of the big companies. Talk about the impact of the big companies.
Yeah.
Because they seem to dominate everything right now.
I think the big companies are dominating a lot of things. I think it's different from the 90s, for example. Really, it was just Microsoft. Windows and, you know, Microsoft and maybe Intel on the other side of it. And everything else got squeezed. I think today it's actually more dynamic and from the perspective you have five companies and then you also have the Chinese giants,
right?
Which I think is a really interesting trend. But I still think there's a lot of room and there's lots of cracks.
Mm-hmm.
I think the thing that's happened is a lot of founders end up selling when they could have kept going because these companies have such large market caps.
Right.
And so the big question in my mind is less about whether there's going to be innovative big companies outside of those big five, but more how long will they keep going? Because Uber could have sold earlier or other companies could have sold earlier and they kept going.
Right.
So the real question is who will keep going and who won't?
Right.
And then who similarly will be aggressive and ambitious? You know, at Google, the primary way that Larry Page would get upset if you were going into a product review is if you weren't thinking big enough.
Right.
He'd always say, why can't this be a $1 billion thing instead of the $100 million thing you're talking about?
Right.
A lot of founders don't do that.
Right.
And so they never do that next wave of product or the next cycle. And so they just lose out. And so I think there's some companies who are doing that now, like Uber with Uber Eats and other services. But I think many of the
They stay in their lane.
Yeah. They stay in their lane a little bit more. And I think that's actually a detriment to innovation.
Why do they do that?
I think it's founder-driven, fundamentally.
Right. They're worried.
Yeah.
Yeah. Lack of creativity is what it is, Elon. No, kidding. No, but they do. They do. But I do think there is, the problem is there was a Microsoft, and then you could sort of, you had a jet ski
around it. Yeah.
But you could, and now the jet skiing is harder because there's big companies, and they don't precisely compete with each other. I'm trying to get this concept to write about it because they don't direct. Like, when I asked Mark what's his competitor, he couldn't come up with one, and he was right. Like, he kind of has competitors, but he doesn't. So they dominate over in this lane, and it's like big semis on the highway. Amazon dominates in this lane. Google dominates on this lane. Apple dominates.
Yeah. I think each of them has a large core primary business that spins off cash that allows them to invest in other areas.
Right.
And it's those other areas where they're competing.
Right.
And so their core dominant area— they're not competing in.
Right. So they get to save that.
But everywhere else they are. So, and I think maybe the place with the biggest overlap would be Android and iPhone.
Yes.
Where that's clear heads-on competition.
Yes, it is. And yet it's not because people make the, you pick your brand, right?
Yeah.
And it's kind of very differentiated and they're not.
And there's also different price points. There's lots of reasons.
Yeah.
But fundamentally, I think there are points of competition. It's more just that each one has their own core.
Around the edges of entertainment, and then there's Hollywood at the same time because it's really interesting. So how do you assess the sort of startup culture right now in Silicon Valley and elsewhere? Mm-hmm. Where do you think the excitement is going on? Obviously,
you were
born in Jerusalem.
Oy vey. I think the thing that I worry most about startup culture is a loss of optimism. And so I actually think that a lot of the rise of cynicism that's been happening in Silicon Valley is a huge net negative because I think ultimately optimism is a reflexive asset.
Me, but go ahead.
In the, like George Soros has this great notion of a reflexive asset. You know, the more people believe in something, the more likely it is to accrete value. And, you know, I think fundamentally optimism is one of those things where the more people believe that you can do great positive things to the world through technology, the more people will. And the bigger you'll think, and therefore to that Larry Page point, the bigger you'll actually accomplish.
Right.
And so one founder that I invested in emailed me a few weeks ago basically saying that he was at a dinner party and everybody started making fun of him because he said he wanted to change the world through his company, which I think is great. You know, there should be people who want to do good things for people through their companies. And so my feedback to him was find better friends. You know? Like, you shouldn't hang out with these
people. Well, there's a weariness factor that comes in and the damage that has clearly been done by some of these companies. And I think you can't, I'm going to push back on this because optimism is good, but some of this optimism has gotten us into the mess that we're in now.
Well, it'd be an example of optimism translating into bad, because I think there's bad behavior translating into bad outcomes.
I think some of these, as I have argued many times, that some of these creations have side effects that they don't want to take responsibility for. And they're heavy. There's some heavy side effects, right?
That's different. That's not about optimism or pessimism. That's about owning your shit.
Right.
In other words,
they conflate the two. Like, oh, you're negative. I'm like, no, you made a fucking mess over here. Clean it up. And I'm not trying to say that you shouldn't do, you know, it reminds me of something I always say, like, you don't, I've said this several times, is that you don't want to be the person at Kitty Hawk saying, oh, they only got 10 feet off the ground.
Sure.
That's shitty.
Yeah.
Like, they flew, right? You want to be, they frigging flew. You want to say that, those Wright brothers.
Yeah, yeah.
And not be the negative or contrarian, for example.
Yeah.
And at the same time, there is a regular and persistent technique that Silicon Valley people do, which is ignore the impact of their inventions.
Yeah. I think those are separable, though. It's sort of like, your kid gets into Harvard, but they never clean their room. They should clean their room.
Right.
But it's still great they got into Harvard.
Yes, exactly.
And so I do think these are separable things.
Yeah.
And I worry that there's such a rise of cynicism relative to anything a tech company does now. Mm-hmm. And I think some of it is earned, right? Like some companies have made all sorts of mistakes along the way. I'm not justifying that at all. I'm just saying it shouldn't bleed over to the 22-year-old person who's really excited about making great change and who's never done all that shit. You know, they should learn from the mistakes of others.
I would also agree that we have celebrated them a lot. They get licked up and down all the time for a decade now. And when people say, just a second, they're not used to that. I think we've sort of raised, it's almost like raised overindulged children.
Yeah, and so it's
everything
sort of
you
like
do
the,
is, here's an award for this.
And I think it's sort of we're swinging back on the pendulum. I just hope we don't swing back too hard. Because I do think there's lots of good that's been done. And I'll give you a very stupid, trivial example, right?
I was stupid. Go ahead.
It's a, you know, I was looking. I wanted to cook some. I have an 18-month-old, so I wanted to cook something for him.
Congratulations!
Thank you. And
if you feed them, they get bigger.
Are you serious? That's how it works.
I had no idea.
It's been working. It was just spontaneous.
They get real big and they eat more.
I was just guessing until now, so I'm glad to hear that.
Move along.
So I was cooking for him, and the way that I found the recipes, I just opened up my phone and I pulled up a recipe and I made it in 2 seconds. You know, 20 years ago, I would have called five people. I would have looked for somebody who knew it, or I'd had to go down to the public library to check out a recipe book. Right? It's actually the amount of information and access that we have in a friction-free way on a global basis is shocking, and people really forget that. Like just 20 years ago, different it was. And so, technology companies have had this massive impact, and they have helped tons of people, and they've, you know, really helped help pull a lot of people out of poverty and other and help solve other issues. That doesn't mean that bad behavior should be excused by any means. I'm just saying if things get really cynical and dark, we're actually going to be shutting down the people who want to do good work. And I think that's a really bad trend.
The only part about that is that, like, Hollywood people make great movies that entertain us. They don't sit around and pat themselves on the back almost continually. And I think,
except for the Oscars.
Who watches those, Who watches those? But, I mean, it's then let's have just an Oscars and then be done with it once a year, you know, kind of thing. Because they literally, if you make one criticism, they're like, but I did this. And I'm like, I'm not really interested in, you know what I mean? It's a really interesting, and again, I think it does, goes to the juvenilization of mostly men here, and so it's that they're not responsible for what they do, and they're not. You can be cynical and you can be honest about yourself. You know what I mean? And I think it's hard. The minute you are honest with them, they think you're being mean, and it's a really interesting thing because I encounter it a lot.
I think that's a generic thing for people who have accumulated enough wealth or power over time, irrespective of industry.
And that's a whole other part. The wealth and power part makes them immune to that because what happens is people lick them up and down all day.
Well, I guess my point is that's true of every industry. That's not tech specific. In other words, if you talk to somebody from the hedge fund world, you talk to somebody who's a famous artist who's done really well, it's every person that I've interacted with, not every person, many people that I've interacted with from other industries have people around them who are basically benefiting but from being close to them.
I think those Wall Street people know they're assholes. I think they never forget. I don't know. I think guys, I think these guys have a bit, they look in the mirror and see a different version of what they're. And it's okay to have a having complex thoughts about yourself is really hard here. It's they're much more reductive.
I blame Twitter.
Yeah, do you? I blame Twitter for everything. That's what I did today. So in finishing up, are we in a high growth period? Because you talked about China, the pressure from China, which is amazingly hard. And as it should be. What do you, give us some predictions of where you what do you think's going to happen, what needs to happen, and then what will happen?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that I worry about is when interest rates eventually come up, and what does that mean for the entire tech economy? And I do think that, you know, half of all the unicorns out there are overvalued. You know, like many of them actually don't have the fundamentals that would get this valuation that they have. And we also have a generation of founders who've grown up in a upmarket. It's been a decade. And a capital-rich environment. And when that shuts down, I think it's going to be really messy for two reasons. One is people haven't dealt with it before. But equally importantly, our government is currently using up everything that you'd normally use during a recession to stimulate things. You'd do tech cuts. You'd have low interest rates. You do all these things. So we're basically, once interest rates do go up and the economy cools down or the ability to have free capital cools down, I think a lot of unicorns will sort of go under. And then secondly, I think the big question is how long will that last? And I don't think it's happening in 6 months. I think it'll happen eventually, but then it could be pretty prolonged in terms of the outcome. So I worry about the macro side. The flip side of it is I am very optimistic about the fact that you can suddenly truly reach billions of people in a friction-free way for the first time. And you do see companies growing faster and bigger than ever. And I think that's because we've created these big efficiencies in markets. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really fascinating trend in terms of company formation, because suddenly you can really get to enormous scale very rapidly like you couldn't before.
Right. And so?
So I think you're going to see more companies getting to, you know, $50, $100 billion market cap than you ever had before. And we're already mm-hmm. seeing that with some of the companies that have existed over the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm. And Silicon Valley being the locus of this?
I think Silicon Valley will be one. I think obviously Beijing and China is another. Mm-hmm. I think Silicon Valley does have risk in part due to just poor governance of the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. And I do worry about the impact that's going to have. And I think people underweight that and actually think it's a real existential threat over
time. I agree. I completely agree. This city has all of them. They just
it's gotten really bad.
The expenses, everything else it creates. So what happens then?
I think
Physical things matter.
Yeah, the real world matters.
Yeah,
you know? I worry about it a lot. I think there's some basic things that could be done around housing, around policing, around helping with mental health or other aspects of homelessness. So I do think there's three or four different areas where interventions would be very valuable. The key question is, will city government actually act on those? Will the tech community engage in those and try and help? And
will
how
will
that
try
evolve?
Try to stop tech people from having lunch?
Yeah, I think that's really a good idea. You know, people shouldn't eat lunch.
Oh, my God.
Intermittent fasting is in.
That guy.
Yeah.
I mean, really.
Yeah.
Like, with all the problems of the city, that's what they go for. I'm going to rip that one.
Yeah. No, there's a great series of tweets around
and
that.
Believe me, I think tech people are over. And I can't believe I'm on the tech people side on this one. But I'm like, are you kidding me?
Yeah, no, it's just bad policies. It's basically San Francisco has made a lot of mistakes over time, and they haven't corrected it. And it seems like if that doesn't correct, you end up with some low point, and then you end up with a Giuliani-type mayor, which is effectively
what happened
in New York. The question is, when does that happen?
Yeah, they either bear hug tech or they kick them in the shins. I'm like, neither of these things are the correct way.
Yeah.
Like, you can force them into really good actions, in a way that helps everybody.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of things that just need to get fixed about the fundamentals of
that's just San Francisco, but it's happening all over the Bay Area. Absolutely. Yeah. All right, do you have any, are you going to start a new company?
Not like anytime soon. So I'm gonna try and recharge a bit.
Have you lost the energy?
I don't think I've lost the energy.
You
definitely see some people who completely never want to start or run a company again. Mm-hmm. I think there's lots of positives to running a company. You know, at least for this stage of my life, like, I want to focus on family and kids and other things. And I think it's harder to do that when you have a startup
rich,
as well.
Yeah, that's the problem.
So the funny thing is, it wasn't until this book that my mom felt like I was going to be okay in life.
You get one of those moms.
Yeah, and so she'd always come and she'd leave, like, you know, the $50 check.
Oh, you're
like,
kidding.
You know, buried in the pile of my mail, so I'd find it after she leaves and all this stuff.
God.
It was very sweet,
that's
right?
Very sweet.
And I kept telling her, look, you should be saving this for your retirement. Like, I'm fine. I can also help, blah, blah, blah. And then when the book came out, it was the first time she didn't do that when she visited. And I think she's
good.
Like, oh, you finally made it. You have a book.
Oh, that's good. Oh,
so
that's
I thought
good.
That was kind of neat.
Successfully.
Yeah.
Thank goodness, because we are all worried.
She's like, you don't have to be a doctor after
all. I'm going to finish one thing, which I finished with lots of people. What's a mistake you made? I know it's a reductive, stupid question, but it actually elicits some very good responses. For a startup founder, what's the one you'd avoid?
I think it depends if it's early or late. Most of the mistakes late are about hiring decisions or just misunderstanding the market or your customers, but typically it's hiring decisions. And hiring could mean things like you don't hire an HR person soon enough, or it could mean that you have the wrong person in place for too long and it kind of screws up an organization in a way that's hard to recover or it takes a while to recover from. For early, you know, the biggest mistakes are continuing down a path that clearly isn't working for too long or fighting with your co-founder.
Okay. Did you do that?
Every co-founder fights.
All right.
I started a second company with Amin, so we obviously work really well together, but I don't know of a single co-founder relationship where there's never been a disagreement.
All right, then. All right. Thank you so much. It's been a really fascinating discussion, Ela, and thanks for coming on the show. If you enjoyed the interview as much as I did, be sure to subscribe to the show. You can find more episodes of Recode Decode on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts, or just visit recode.net/podcast for more. And if you have a minute, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and tell other people about the show. That helps them discover great interviews like this one. Now that you're done with this, go check out the latest episode of Recode Media. You can find that show wherever you found this one. And Eled's book, just so you know, is called High Growth Handbook, Scaling Startups from 10 to 10,000 People. A million people told me I had to interview him, and they were unfortunately right. I'm wrong as usual. Thanks for coming on. And thanks for listening to this episode of Recode Decode. Thanks to our editor, Joel Robbie, and our producer, Eric Johnson. I'll be back here on Wednesday. Tune in then.
Hi, we're Visible. We're the wireless company with nothing to hide. Seriously. Hidden fees? We don't have them. Annual contracts? Not our thing. Great wireless on just one line? Now that's more like it. Get unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month. Taxes and fees included. That's right, $25 a month, every month. Sorry, hidden fees. We're just not that into you. Sometimes the choice is just Visible. Switch today at Visible.com. Rate with service on the Visible plan. For additional terms and network management practices, see Visible.com.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure. It's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.